From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today, as we inch closer to having vaccines to fight the coronavirus, a panel of independent advisors to the CDC will take up that question today. Who should get it first? Healthcare workers and residents of long-term care facilities and nursing homes are expected to be among the first in line. Dr. Kritika Kapali, assistant professor at the Medical University of South Carolina and vice chair of the Infectious Diseases Society of America Global Health Committee, is here. And Dr. Kapali, do you agree healthcare workers, you know, the elderly who need care and, you know, having those terrible outbreaks in nursing homes, for instance, do you think they should be first in line?
Well, yes, I definitely think healthcare workers should definitely be first in line for getting the vaccine. They are the ones who are putting their lives on the line for taking care of patients. And we've already had a number of healthcare workers get infected, not just here, but all over the world. And if healthcare workers get sick or die, then we don't have anybody to help take care of patients. So they are a precious commodity and need to be protected at every step along the way.
Yeah. What questions do you have? We're going to raise a few more of the categories, but what questions do you have as this question, who gets it first, is being considered?
Yeah. So I think, you know, one of the biggest debates that we're having right now is, you know, where do we put essential workers along the line in terms of adults who are over the age of 65? We know that adults over the age of 65, particularly those who are living in congregant settings, those with multiple comorbidities are at increased risk of getting COVID. However, we also know that essential workers who don't necessarily work in healthcare are also at increased risk just by being out there in the nature of their job. And so this is going to be a very difficult situation. And I think it's going to be important to know that, you know, it's not that it's one group, then the next group, and then the next group. There'll be some overlap between the groups. So, you know, we'll start one group and then as we get more vaccine, then start the next group and then start the next group. So hopefully as we get more vaccine available, we'll be able to include more and more people.
Well, and people can go to the CDC website where you can click through links and eventually get to what the definition of an essential worker is or someone in a critical industry. But it's very vague. So it feels like there's going to be a lot of questions there. You know, we were calling people, you know, checking out groceries essential. You know, are they going to be ahead of, you know, let's say somebody else in line for the vaccine? These sound like some of the questions. And are there going to be enough doses? We should explain that Pfizer and Moderna at one point said between them they could have about 40 million doses, but we have to take two doses, and this is at the end of December. So that cuts it down to about 20 million people, and there are 21 million healthcare workers in the country. So lots of questions to be asked.
Yeah, yeah. So Pfizer has said that they will have 50 million doses by the end of the year. So that would be enough for 25 million people. And then Moderna has said, I believe, 15 million doses by the end of the year. So that's enough for 7.5 million people. And again, you know, that's assuming that every single person is going to be vaccinated. We still have a lot of work to do with not just rolling out the vaccine, but really spending a lot of time with community engagement and trying to get people to take up the vaccine. So science has done its job and produced what looks like to be a very efficacious vaccine, which is really wonderful news. But now we have to do our job and really educate the community and educate people to go out and get the vaccine. And so that's going to be a really important thing that we do now going forward.
As well as manufacturing enough so that when they do decide to go, there are two doses for them. And again, the CDC has an advisory panel today. They're going to say, though, to them, people with underlying concerns, should they be among the first? And they'll get a yay or a nay. Dr. Kritika Kapali, assistant professor at the Medical University of South Carolina, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, COVID-19 is only the latest pandemic. On this World AIDS Day, we remember the 33 million people who've died worldwide from that disease. And we recall the silence and inaction of the 1980s when the virus was ripping through gay communities. That's why activists formed the AIDS Coalition ACT UP. Their logo, a single pink triangle, and the words silence equals death. Avram Finkelstein is one of the group's founders. Avram, welcome.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
And how are you feeling on this World AIDS Day as another pandemic is now raging across the globe?
As this is my second pandemic, it's triggering to say the least. I think that all of my cohort, everyone who lived through the early days of HIV/AIDS, thinks about the questions about mortality and memory and public memory all the time. So I think that we live in a separate world already, but now in another way, the entire world is participating in this new pandemic in such an accelerated way that I think we're not going to fully understand its impact for decades.
You say it's triggering. Is the public reaction and the government reaction to this pandemic today part of the reason that it's triggering for you?
I think the government agencies and the government reaction, it's the same agencies, the CDC, the NIH, the FDA are the same agencies involved in COVID-19 as were involved in HIV/AIDS. So I think that the parallels are so obvious, and it's one of the triggering factors is Tony Fauci is still there. In my circle, Tony Fauci is very well known. He's now a public figure again. So it's almost impossible to avoid the personal implications of hearing these same agencies, these same names occurring now. The difference is, of course, the rapidity of and communicability of COVID-19 is so radically different from how HIV/AIDS was communicated that the whole world is going through this moment together. And that's a very big difference.
Yeah. Well, looking back, it's hard to believe now that President Ronald Reagan didn't even mention HIV or AIDS until 1985. It was 4 years after the crisis began, and that's why so many activists like you started speaking out, saying silence equals death. Just remind us how you got involved in the early days of the crisis and what you were going through.
I think history tends to compact events. So when people think about AIDS activism and ACT UP in particular in 1987, it appears to have been some sort of explosive response, but for those of us on the front lines, like myself, AIDS was a slow-motion train wreck that began in 1981 and was largely suffered in silence. And I think what ACT UP was a function of was this years of building up of this lack of conversation, lack of support, and dealing individually with the trauma of HIV/AIDS. The man I was building my life around started showing signs of immunosuppression in 1981, and he was dead in 1984. So I had been going through it for a really long time and formed a small collective, a consciousness-raising collective with six friends, and all of us were there the day ACT UP started.
Now it's been 40 years. And there's been significant progress made with therapeutics, but there, you know, clearly no vaccine. How are you feeling about where things stand in the fight against this disease?
Part of the question mark about HIV/AIDS in particular for people in the community is that it appears to be something that's been eradicated, but in fact it hasn't. There's 36, 38 million people living with HIV all over the world, and the questions of treatment access and stigma and HIV criminalization and the elusive cure are still issues that are very much alive for people who are in the AIDS community.
Yeah. And if we go back to COVID for just a moment, we're on the verge of getting a vaccine distributed for COVID-19 less than a year after the outbreak. Now, you've said it, and it's true. They're very different diseases. But is it surprising to you, maybe even shocking to you, how quickly this vaccine appeared when, you know, the world has been waiting for decades for a vaccine for HIV?
Well, they're not unrelated questions, and I'm going to wonk out for a minute and then, and talk to you like you're another treatment activist, but the technologies and methodologies of research that might actually lead to a potential cure for HIV are rooted right inside of the technologies that have made the COVID-19 vaccine so quick. The reason why these vaccines have been brought to the market, as it were, so quickly is decades of research.
Avram Finkelstein, founder of ACT UP, AIDS activist, artist, writer based in Brooklyn, thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome.
It's been 9 months since the pandemic forced many schools to halt in-person classes, and most are still struggling to decide what's the best way forward. So what are the long-term consequences? What could this disrupted education do to a child years from now? Avi Wolfman-Arendt of member station WHYY in Philadelphia examines that question through the lens of one vital academic skill, reading.
This is mainly where they are. So our printer's right here.
Yolanda Biggers is not taking virtual school lightly. When her kids' school in North Philadelphia went online, she turned her dining room into a mini classroom.
So right now we have pencil jars. Everybody make sure they have headphones, dry erase markers.
Biggers is kind of a super mom. Her husband works long hours managing a dollar store, so she recently quit her job as a part-time nurse to focus exclusively on their three daughters. The youngest is 7-year-old Zaya. She's in second grade.
It's kind of stressful because I love, like, getting up and stuff. I don't feel like just sitting in a chair and listen.
Zaya loves math class, but when it comes to reading, she's lukewarm.
It's a little bit hard because, like, I struggle a lot. And I come to my mom and say, Mom, with this word, with that word.
Biggers has no problem reading the words back to Zaya.
But if I'm trying to show her how to sound a word out, that's a lot that if you don't know how to explain to your child, and it's an important part of reading, that they may miss.
In the U.S., there are about 15 million public and charter school kids in grades K through 3. Those are the years when we expect students to learn and master the basics of reading. Zaya is one of those 15 million. Her mom says she's right on grade level, but she wonders whether Zaya can keep up while trying to learn from home.
The skills that the teachers have as far as phonics and being able to break words down and showing your kids how to put words together and sound them out, that's key because that's a learned skill and that's something that you have to learn to teach.
And experts agree. Fumiko Haft, a University of Connecticut researcher who studies early literacy, says most students need
systematic instruction that's based on the science of reading.
Reading is the academic version of a skeleton key. If you learn to read well, it opens the door to other subjects like history, science, even math. If you don't read well, everything else becomes tougher. And any disruption, any little setback now, can become a big problem later.
COVID is artificially creating this small gap that is going to impact the kids for life.
It's too early to know whether this past spring's school closures significantly harmed reading development. There's just no data. We also don't know how effective reading instruction will be online, but advocates predict some sort of regression. Jenny Bagoni runs the Read by Fourth campaign, a Philadelphia effort to boost early literacy.
You're not going to likely have just suddenly a whole large group of kids who can't read at all, right? You'll just have kids whose reading skill is less good than it should be.
What happens when kids read maybe 10% worse than they otherwise would have? It's the kind of thing West Philadelphia mom Serena Baker thinks about with her son Roman, who just started kindergarten.
This pandemic definitely slowed down the progress that we was making.
Roman is a bright kid, but he's struggling with the basics of letter and sound recognition. Just before the pandemic, Baker got a tutor for Roman through a shelter where they were living at the time. Things were looking up until he started online school this fall through a cyber charter program.
Now we're kind of back to the attitude. He doesn't want to do it. I'm like, we're working on it for hours.
As Roman's enthusiasm drops, so does his mom's self-esteem.
It makes me feel like, what am I doing wrong?
Baker knows Roman will learn to read. That's not her fear. Her fear is that he won't learn quickly enough to embrace school and unlock all of his other gifts.
Now I feel like he's just going to be just enough to get by. I don't want that for my child.
Roman is only 6 years old. He still has his entire academic career in front of him. But at least when it comes to reading, the clock is already ticking. For Here and Now, I'm Abby Wolfman-Aaron.
Well, the pandemic has also meant nurses and doctors are being called back from retirement to help out with the overwhelming situation for healthcare workers. Well, here's a story of one of those nurses who volunteered. 70-year-old Iris Maida grew up in Harlem, worked some tough nursing jobs, including at Rikers Island Correctional Facility, before moving to Texas. She retired in January, but she was vibrant, a dancer, and she jumped back in again as a nursing teacher at Collin College, where in October, one of her students unwittingly infected her. She died on November 14th. Her daughter, Celine Maida Schlemel, joins us from Dallas. Celine, November 14th, this is still so raw. We are so sorry.
Thank you.
Well, and what did you think? I mean, we know how tough this pandemic was in Texas. At around the time, it seems like she jumped back in. What did you think when she decided to go back towards teaching nursing with people who were going to be exposed?
Well, she retired in January of 2020 from North Texas Job Corps, where she was in direct contact with students. They lived on campus, so she had extended contact with them. So we were actually breathing a sigh of relief because it seemed like she retired just in the nick of time. When she applied to Collin College, the colleges, as well as the other educational institutions, they were all closed. So we were under the impression that her instruction would be virtual. So it wasn't until she started that she realized that she would be in the classrooms, and she really enjoyed it, and she felt like she would be safe. She just didn't understand that she would be doing the labs. But by the time she realized the proximity, she was already involved and really, really excited and really committed to what she was doing.
Yeah. When you work with someone in a lab situation, you may be right over their shoulder overseeing it. As a nurse, as a 70-year-old nurse, she took so many precautions. Was she surprised that she got sick?
She was surprised because she was wearing N95s that she was able to order. And she did have eyeglasses that she felt protected her to a certain extent. But she did say, why did I not wear a face shield? Because she had it. And she just kind of got a little lax the way most of us do.
Yeah. Oh, a face shield. It's such a reminder. You can get them for pennies. Your mom, we know it got so bad. I mean, could you see her given that she was getting sick, or did you have to stay away?
I had to stay away the last time I saw my mother was when I dropped her off at an emergency room in North Dallas, and they would not allow her in the waiting room. We had to wait in the drive-through, and when a triage nurse came out, now mind you, I'm watching my mother who has given her life in service as a nurse, and she's hunched over, gasping for breath on an outdoor bench in a drive-through in front of an emergency room. I begged them to come help her. And I tried to go into the triage area with her because she had some drug allergies, and they were adamant about me not even going into the triage area with her for fear that I may also be infected. So the last time I saw my mother was me screaming to the triage nurse to please take her and please care for her. I was not able to see my mother again until she had already passed.
You know, she was intubated.
Yes, that's correct.
And died on November 14th. You know, I'm so sorry. But I'm wondering if, you know, the only thing that, you know, you could take from this is that your mother was a nurse. She wanted to teach. She wanted to educate other young people. Her last life lesson was her life.
And my mother was the kind of woman who was always looking to be of service. She touched many people in her life, in her profession. There are so many women that have come forward and said that my mother was like a mother to them, or my mother befriended them when they desperately needed someone to support them. So it's not a surprise to me that she felt this call to education and that she felt safe within that construct. My only wish is that her students really understand what it means to not only receive the lesson, the skill, the detail that she was trying to impart to them, but to also always do your very best and always look for ways to support each other, because that is truly her legacy.
Well, and I mean, it's just heartbreaking, but I'm betting you would also say that they could honor her by wearing those face shields, you know, and wearing those face masks.
Exactly. Yeah. I've ordered a little under 400 that I'm waiting to arrive so I can donate to the college. We are having a funeral service on Saturday, so I'll have a face shield for everyone who attends, and the remainder will go directly to the teachers at Collin College.
And of course, socially distanced.
Yes, yes, of course, definitely. Last thing I would ever want to do is pass this hurt on to another family.
Well, we have to say, it's so obvious her number one student took all of this in, and that's you. I thank you so much, Celine, and I, you know, we all just are so sorry for your loss.
Thank you for having me.
Celine Maida Schlemel, remembering her mother Iris.
Support for Here and Now in the following message is brought to you by the New England Innovation Academy, an innovative engine for students in grades 6 through 12, the first middle and high school that prepares innovators to shape the world through human-centered design. Part world school, part incubator, teaching the cultural dexterity and global focus this era demands. To learn more, visit neiacademy.org.
A federal watchdog agency has found that the government is underpaying millions of workers receiving unemployment benefits through a special pandemic relief program. The Government Accountability Office also said in its report Monday that the Labor Department has inaccurately reported the number of people who filed jobless claims every week since the pandemic began. Let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. And Robin, let's go big picture first. So the GAO saying the Labor Department has published this flawed data in its weekly unemployment report. This is what lawmakers and investors rely on. So we're undercounting the unemployed, it sounds like. How did this happen, and what's the impact?
Well, it speaks to how instantly the economy just really fell off a cliff within a few days and how volatile everything became. Reporting, the system, I mean, the bond markets. The weekly reporting, kind of on a mundane level for states, it already couldn't adequately count case backlogs. And simultaneously, this report observed that people who filed multiple counts inflated state unemployment numbers. And so one laid-off worker who waited a month to file a claim might have been counted as four people once, you know, the application was finally digested by the system. And if you step back from all of that gets amplified when everyone is holding their breath waiting for these weekly Labor Department statistics.
Oh, so I just want to be clear. Are you saying not just undercounting, but maybe overcounting?
Yeah, it happened in both ways. And that's why it gives grist to kind of critics that are saying that it's a wasteful process, we should starve it of money, and others that are saying people are not getting adequately compensated.
Yeah, and by the way, the GAO is asking the Labor Department to revise the numbers. Is that possible?
I think it's a bit like herding cats. I mean, going back and double, triple checking state by state. The Labor Department, for its part, it's pushing back. I mean, even if we weren't between presidential administrations, These state unemployment offices, you guys have covered it. They're already overwhelmed with the task at hand. The GAO wants the Labor Department to correct the data. Hundreds of billions of dollars are at stake. But for whatever it's worth, the department has only, what, quote, partially agreed to a recommendation to use state data more accurately.
Well, but what about individuals? Many states, the GAO says, are underpaying people who applied for benefits under a federal program that helps gig workers and people who are self-employed. Many are only getting the minimum amount instead of what they'd qualify for based on their previous pay. So are people going to get that money that's owed to them?
The striking stat here is that the average weekly payout under the Special Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program, which you point out is key aid for gig workers, that's below the poverty line in 70% of states, according to the reported data. And so that is hugely problematic in that a lot of people are getting short shrifted.
Well, but what do you think? I mean, will there be some back pay on that?
Yeah, the GAO said the states are obligated to pay out the full amount that is owed with the greatest promptness that is administratively feasible. And that just leaves a lot of gray area, I think, over the next several months.
And very briefly, Robin, while we have it, we know that we've mentioned elsewhere, members of Congress came out today with that proposal for pandemic relief. It's much more than Republicans wanted, much less than Democrats wanted. Do you think these findings could affect the relief that goes forward?
I just think it's marginal. It's on the margin data. This is a $908 billion stopgap to a Biden administration, these lawmakers are saying, with no direct payment. And I'm not sure it goes the distance, even in this environment with kind of the lame duck White House and Congress.
Got to hold up there. Robin Farzad of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Thank you.
President Trump has less than 2 months left in office, and experts anticipate a number of new pardons before he goes. Trump recently pardoned his former National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn, and there's speculation the president may even pardon himself. Here's Sean Hannity on Fox News yesterday, responding to a New York Times op-ed calling for the next attorney general to investigate Trump for federal crimes.
The president out the door needs to pardon his whole family and himself because they want this witch hunt to go on in perpetuity. I assume that the power of the pardon is absolute and that he should be able to pardon anybody that he wants to.
Joining us now is Dan Coble. He's professor of law at Capital University Law School in Columbus, Ohio. Dan, welcome. It's good to speak with you.
Great to speak with you, Peter.
Well, and there's some fodder for a conversation that we just heard there from Sean Hannity. We'll get there. But first, how would you characterize what the president has done so far to date? We just saw him pardon Michael Flynn. What are you expecting in the next couple months?
Honestly, Peter, I am expecting a floodgate of pardons for every crony and family member that may have committed a crime in the past 4 years. I think that the New York Times is reporting today that Rudy Giuliani has discussed receiving a pardon with President Trump. So I think that that's what we can expect to come.
And what about his family members? I mean, if we look back in relatively recent history, President Clinton controversially pardoned his brother for drug trafficking charges. Do you think the Trump family could be on the receiving end of a pardon?
I absolutely do. I think that given speculation that there may have been federal tax laws violated or possibly fraud, that a preemptive pardon of family members is in the offing. Now, we have to remember that when Clinton pardoned his brother had served his sentence. So it was a pardon that essentially forgave him for his crime, but didn't obviate punishment.
So any Trump family pardons would be very high profile, but there are also pardons that go through the Office of the Pardon Attorney at the Department of Justice. Lower profile for sure. What's happening with those right now? Do you know?
With regard to the Office of the Pardon Attorney, Trump really has not used them. Almost all of the pardons that have been issued have gone directly through the White House. That's highly unusual. Most presidents use the Office of the Pardon Attorney to ensure that the pardon power isn't being used in cases where they don't know all the facts, where there hasn't been a thorough investigation, or to prevent accusations of cronyism. And those sorts of pardons to little people who are unconnected have really not been happening.
All right. I want to mention some past pardons here throughout history. We mentioned Clinton, but President Ford, of course, had a very controversial pardon of Richard Nixon after Watergate. Here is Ford in September of 1974, shortly after taking office.
I, Gerald R. Ford, President of the United States, pursuant to the pardon power conferred upon me by Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution, have granted, and by these presents do grant, a full, free, and absolute pardon unto Richard Nixon.
Well, that was a very big deal at the time, and it was for a time period between 1969 and 1974. You spoke to President Ford about why he pardoned Nixon. What did he tell you?
President Ford told me that he felt he had to do it in order for the country to get on with the very difficult issues that he faced coming in as president. There were a lot of economic issues, security issues that he wanted to deal with, and he felt that obsession with Richard Nixon would prevent that. I asked him, by granting that pardon that, as you mentioned, was for a five-year period, was he afraid that he was pardoning Nixon for things that he didn't even know about? And Ford replied, well, I knew I was pardoning him for obstruction of justice, and to me that seemed bad enough. That was the most he could imagine that Nixon would have done. The other thing that Ford mentioned is that it was very important to him that the Supreme Court had said that by accepting his pardon, Nixon was admitting that he had been guilty of crimes against the United States.
Did Nixon consider not accepting the pardon?
Yes. In fact, there were negotiations between the Ford team and former President Nixon about the extent to which he would admit guilt. He ultimately would not. But Ford carried around the U.S. Supreme Court case that says that acceptance of a pardon admits guilt in order that he could rebut criticisms that Nixon had gotten off scot-free.
Well, that is some very interesting context for today. Now, it is very unlikely that Joe Biden would follow in Ford's footsteps. Earlier this year, before the election, he said he would not pardon Trump. But it raises the question, one that we got to at the very beginning, could President Trump pardon himself? And we should add, he has not been charged with a federal crime, but clearly people are talking about it.
Well, President Trump believes he can pardon himself, and indeed Nixon considered it. But it was ultimately rejected when the Justice Department said that he would not have that authority. As a legal matter, we frankly do not know for certain whether a self-pardon would be permitted. Some experts argue absolutely not. Other experts say absolutely yes. The Constitution does not bar a self-pardon. On the other hand, the Constitution uses the word grant, which in other contexts suggests a conveyance to another person. So that and the prohibitions that the constitutional framers seem to recognize on self-dealing would argue that he could not grant himself a pardon. So it would ultimately come down to two things. One, whether the Biden administration or U.S. attorney decided to prosecute Trump for federal crimes. And two, then whether if that pardon were provided as an obstacle to the prosecution, a court would decide whether this were constitutional or not.
Right, because the key here is no president has ever tried it before, so we don't know. There's also some speculation, this seems very unlikely, that President Trump would step down briefly while still in office, give President Pence the keys to the White House for a time, and then Pence could pardon the president. What do you think about that?
It is certainly a possibility. It might make Pence the most ignominious president in history for a day, but it is certainly a possibility that that could happen. Indeed, there was often speculation that there had been some sort of nefarious deal struck by Ford and Nixon to achieve just that result.
Could the president pardon himself secretly so that nobody knew about it until further down the road?
That's something that is certainly within the authority of the president to do. There's no requirement that his pardon warrant be public.
So did the founders make a mistake here, giving the president so much power? Do you think it's been used well over the years?
I think the pardon power has been underused over at least modern times until today. And in fact, even President Trump has underused it for the people who perhaps might be said to be most deserving of pardons. On the other hand, I think the pardons countenance that we would have mostly heroes in office and not those who would abuse the pardon power. So generally our constitutional norms, not necessarily express rules, have protected us against major abuses of the pardon power. I think the possibility of a president pardoning himself would have disturbed them, because think about it. What this would suggest is that the president could order the assassination of political opponents in Washington, D.C., pardon the perpetrators and himself for any involvement in it. That certainly seems like the sort of thing that the framers would have objected to from the King of England, and there's no reason to think that they would have wanted the President of the United States to be able to do that.
Well, Dan Kobel, you've given us something to think about here. Professor at Capital University Law School in Columbus, Ohio. Thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Peter. Pleasure to be here.
You may have heard of that mysterious stainless steel monument rising out of the Utah desert, like the 2001 Space Odyssey obelisks discovered by Bureau of Land Management agents flying overhead last week, glinting among the red rocks. It attracted hikers and an article in the New York Times that speculated it might be the work of a late sculptor. Well, it's gone. Zach Podmore is a reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. He's also a Report for America Corps member. And Zach, you went out to see this thing when it was first found. We'll have pictures at herenow.org, but there were all these people trekking out to see it. And then over the weekend, what happened?
Yeah, so I went out first 2 days after the press release came out. There were a handful of people out there. I saw maybe six people at the sculpture itself, and then a lot more coming in as I was leaving, maybe 20, 30 people throughout the day. I went back 4 days later over the weekend, and it was a completely different scene. Hundreds of cars on this road that's really rough, dusty, hard to get to, people getting stuck. And of course, the sculpture, which everyone had come from all over to see, including from as far away as L.A. and Kansas, which are long drives to this part of Utah. The sculpture was gone. It had been removed in the middle of the night, Friday night. And there have been a few reports that people saw, you know, somebody removing it. But nobody knows the full story yet of how it was placed there or how it was exactly removed.
And we should say BLM, the Bureau of Land Management officials, they say they didn't remove it. Now, look, there was speculation over the weekend with an article in the New York Times that this was the work of a famous artist who since died, who said that he wanted to leave some of his sculptures in different places for people to find. His son said that. Is there a sense that that's true? It's hard to believe that if that were true, it was, perhaps a valuable sculpture, a part of it would be left because a piece of it was just kind of lying there on the ground. What is the sense of what this is or was?
Yeah, not a lot is known about who made it, an artist, a group of artists, somebody who's, just this could be their first work. Nobody really knows. The John McCracken speculation is hotly debated. Even within that New York Times article, there was a lot of, going back and forth between different people who knew him about whether this could be one of his sculptures. It's not quite as well made as many of the sculptures he created throughout his life. It's just riveted together stainless steel sheeting. He would typically use a higher quality material and weld it at the edges and cover up the seams and that sort of thing. Also, he passed away in 2011, I believe, and many people think this sculpture was installed sometime in 2016 based on Google Earth satellite imagery. So, it's debated still, and I hope eventually the story comes out about who's behind this.
Look, this is in what was a part of the Bear's Ears monument or refuge until that was reduced. Are there people thinking that, you know, people there in Utah thinking, we are so glad this is gone because we want to preserve, you know, this land, not have people trample over it?
Absolutely, yeah. Just in a few short days, like I said, there was so much damage done to this area that really doesn't see any visitation in a normal year, as is evidenced by the fact that this thing was out there for 4 years with nobody finding it. The place where it was located was part of Bears Ears National Monument, which was created at the request of 5 Native American tribes in 2016 by President Obama. It was reduced a year later by President Trump. And this area was in a canyon that was removed from the monument by President Trump in 2017. You know, typically to do a project like this on federal public land in or out of a monument, you'd need permission from the federal agencies involved, and they would also consult with Native American tribes, in this case, in the Bears Ears area. So that wasn't done. This was installed illegally, and you know, there's a lot of people who are upset about the fact that it was put out there as well.
Yeah. And yet I just have to ask, are there some people thinking, gosh, maybe, you know, excited about it, thinking, maybe it is aliens?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, there's a lot of excitement, too. And it was an impressive piece of art when you're standing out there beside it, but before it was taken away. It was, you know, its placement in this really remote canyon, this beautiful bowl of red sandstone, was a really nice contrast with the metal gleaming, you know, stainless steel structure. And it was really cool to walk around and see it. So a lot of people appreciated it for its artistic qualities. And then, of course, the whole mystery surrounding it, too. Who put it there? Who took it away? There's a lot of UFO enthusiasts who are, you know, on YouTube talking about this still. So I think the excitement will continue for a little while longer.
Nothing to see here, people. Zach Podmore of the Salt Lake Tribune, thank you so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Peter, there's also a mountain statue that disappeared in Germany. Coincidence? I don't think so.
Oh, I don't know about that, but a mystery in the desert. I love that story.
I know you do. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. It is Here and Now.